Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and work of queer Chicana poet, essayist, and theorist, Gloria E. Anzaldúa. From the Gloria Anzaldúa Reader from Duke University Press, quote, "Born in the Rio Grande Valley of South Texas, Gloria Anzaldúa was an internationally acclaimed cultural theorist. As the author of Borderlands, La Frontera, The New Mestiza, Anzaldúa played a major role in shaping contemporary Chicano/Chicana and lesbian/queer theories and identities. As an editor of three anthologies, including the groundbreaking This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color, she played an equally vital role in developing an inclusive, multicultural feminist movement," end quote. For this episode, we are joined by Ana Louise Keating, professor of multicultural women's and gender studies at Texas Woman's University and personal friend of Anzaldúa, and Irena Lara Silva, 2023 Texas State Poet Laureate and multi-genre writer. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Ana Louise and Irena are interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place September 17th, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Ana Louise and Irena, for joining me today on the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm looking forward to talking to you about Gloria E. Anzaldúa and her work and what it means to you. But before we get into that, could you tell us a little bit about yourselves, what you're up to now, and perhaps how you first encountered Anzaldúa's work? Ana Louise, would you like to get us started?
Sure. I'm Ana Louise. I'm a professor of multicultural women's and gender studies at Texas Woman's University. I have known Anzaldúa since, I think, 1991. I was a scholar of her work when I had an opportunity to meet her and interview her. And through a combination of things in my life that at that time were like not that great, I ended up editing a book of her interviews and working with her on a few projects and becoming friends with her. And I've edited some of her books after her passing, and I've written about her quite a bit. So that's kind of my connection to Anzaldúa. My current project is I'm working on a book on spiritual activism, very indebted to Anzaldúa. And in addition to teaching, I'm a co-owner in a yoga studio, so I teach a lot of yoga.
Very good. Very fun. Irena, how about yourself?
So I'm Irene Lara Silva. I just moved to San Antonio about 5 months ago after being in Austin for 25 years, I think. And so I'm very much enjoying my new city. I'm a poet, writer, and apparently have been adding as many genres as possible to that since I just came out with a comic book, and I've been writing for Texas Highways magazine. And I used to be upset that people kept asking me as a poet to write essays, but apparently I now do it of my own free will, which I find very disturbing. And what else? What I'm up to right now, I'm part of a very fascinating photo poetry project on Mexican-American escaramuzas, which is currently at the National Cowgirl Museum and Hall of Fame in Fort Worth. And it will be traveling to Chicago, El Paso, and other parts in the next few years. So that's been amazing. And I am finishing up the last story for my second collection of short stories, which will be out in the spring from Arte Público.
Wonderful. Thank you. I look forward to that when it comes to Chicago. Irena, you mentioned kind of taking on more and more genres. That made me think of Anzaldúa herself and her prolific work across genres, forms, topics. I wonder if either of you could speak to that a little bit, either, you know, perhaps how she was able to do that and to do it so effectively. Did any of those other forms or genres inform each other as well? Because that was one thing I found was just her decades of prolificness across various forms. So I wonder if either of you would like to speak to that.
You know, it's so interesting because if you go all the way back to the late 70s, Anzaldúa specifically described herself as a poet. And in fact, her most famous book, Borderlands, La Frontera, The New Mestiza, started as a book of poetry. And that's what Aunt Ruth accepted. And if you look at Anzaldúa's writings and letters, she's like, hey, I'm going to write a little intro to it. And the little intro that she wrote to it is the prose part, which is what gets the most of the attention. So it's taken... She's more recognized as a poet now, but it's taken a really long time to recognize her as a poet. And yet, that is the main way she saw herself for much of her own career.
That it's interesting because I think the way that I've made peace with writing different genres, and I'm now working on a novel and also a children's book, is that I finally decided that everything was poetry. So my connection with Ansaldúa, I never met her, and while she was alive, I never saw her read or speak while she was living. But interestingly enough, the high school I graduated from is 10 miles away from Hargill. And so I'm from the Rio Grande Valley, and I actually didn't encounter borderlands until I was in college, early 90s in upstate New York. So before that, before 93, I had no idea that that Latina or Chicana people had ever published or written books at all, because I was never exposed to that in high school. I had absolutely no familiarity or knowledge of it. So it wasn't until, and then interestingly, I found out years later that she wrote Borderlands when she was in New York, yes. In the state of New York. And I thought, that's just crazy. Like, we both had to go 2,000 miles away in order to, you know, really, in some ways, reflect on what the frontera, the border, Rio Grande Valley, what that was, and what it meant to be from there while living in upstate New York and having a completely different experience of what it meant to be who we were and where we were from. And I started college as a mechanical engineer. That lasted exactly 6 weeks because a Latina professor of mine lent me her personal copy of This Bridge Called My Back. And that just exploded everything. So I was 4 or 5 weeks into my freshman year of college when that happened. And so that was a tremendous thing. And then it's been interesting to me through time, all the different ways that her influence, her life and mine, coincidences and intersections and overlapping sort of things that have happened since that time. I myself have been an insulin dependent diabetic for 16 years, and most of my family has been, and I've had a lot of family members die from diabetic complications. And then on top of that, from the very beginning, there was something about Ansaldúa's work that deeply spoke to me. And I find that over time, you know, I go back to read the work and keep finding more and more to think about. Of course, now that I'm getting older, I'm also finding more and more things to argue with. So I find that really interesting. And now I wish I could argue. But, of course, too, you know, over time, over decades of writing, you have different relationships to what your writing is and what writing is in your life. And what you think of writing when it comes to thinking about it in terms of medicine or transformation or wounds and healing and history and all of that.
Thank you for that. Yeah, the parallels really are striking. And you mentioned as well, just the a writer's relationship to writing, which Ansaldúa also writes about and talks about. You know, I came across actually in your book, Ana Luis, the Gloria Ansaldúa reader, you quote a passage of Ansaldúa's from When I Write, I Hover. It says, "I write because it's my calling, my task to do in the world. I write. It is a ritual, a habit, a propensity bred in my bones. It is what I do. I write because I like to think on paper. I write because I like to think and to track my thoughts. I write because I want to leave a discernible mark on the world." Which I just love, and you know, clearly she did do that as we're, you know, talking about her now. And I'm wondering, as you are both writers, like, have you found any insights from Ansaldúa that you've applied to your own relation to your life as a writer? Do you feel a similar calling like that?
I love that you like pulled that out of all her stuff to quote, because it speaks to her life. Like, she gave up everything for her writing. Like, she really did. She had a knack for falling in love with people who were unobtainable. After she left graduate school, she decided never to work full time. So she lived on food stamps. She lived on money. Her family, even her little niece, would send her in order to keep devoting her time to her writing. This meant that when she had bad dental problems, she didn't go to a dentist. She just tried to treat it with, you know, garlic or things like that, which of course impacted her health, right? And of course is part of what contributed probably to her ability to I don't think fight the diabetes is fight is not the right word, but it shortened her life. I'm sure it shortened her life, right? She was lonely at times. All of it because she married Musa Bruba, because she committed everything. Like that was number one, her top thing. Yeah. So I think one of the things I learned from that is it's important to try to seek balance, right? I'm not a very balanced person and I'm pretty obsessed with, I know I've always wanted to be a writer. Ironically, I thought I'd be a fiction writer. And it turns out I write like theory, but I totally agree with Irene that all writing is poetry because I really try to make my prose beautiful. Like I was very influenced by Ralph Waldo Emerson, whose prose is also beautiful. So I really want, I think when the words sing and when they move a certain way, they go into people, into readers a certain way, and they can have an impact as well. You know, that can be part of the work that they're doing. And also the confidence, I think another thing I learned from Anzal Dua, and I think we see it in something like her theory of the Coatlicue state in Borderlands La Frontera. If you stay present, even with those painful writing blocks or with those painful things and just stay present with them, it's not guaranteed, but there can be breakthroughs. So that's another thing I learned, like when I am ready to give up on the writing. Like, no, I just have to stay with it and, you know, seize some hope somewhere.
I've got about seven different thoughts fighting in my brain right now. The first thing, Ana Luise, is extremely important. So probably 2016, 2017, maybe, I don't know, somewhere in there, I was reading the appendices to Light in the Dark because I like to read books backwards. And so I started, you know, with this one of the letters and emails that she wrote. And I was on a bus on my way to work because I had about an hour 15 long commute and on a bus in the mornings to get to work. And I was completely struck mute and like had an epiphany that was, I'm going to say, life changing. So I have at this point worked 26 years with the state of Texas and Travis County in an administrative capacity. And for most of those years, up until I read that appendix, I absolutely hated my job, every single minute of it, every day, every year, because I had wanted to go and just write and live however and travel and be free. But family obligations and different things kind of made me have to stay in one place, made me have to work one, two, three jobs at a time. But it wasn't until I read those letters from Gloria and that specific morning that I was on the bus that I suddenly had this epiphany, I had this overwhelming gratitude for the difficulties in my life that had made me have to have a full-time job. Because of that, I'd had the health insurance to deal with all of the diabetic complications. As well as, you know, dental and vision care and everything else. Because of that, I had been able to take care of my brother who passed away 2 years ago. But if I hadn't had a steady job and everything else, I wouldn't have had a place to take care of him for 19 years. And if it hadn't been for all the decades that I spent working at this, I wouldn't be retiring 3.5 months from today. And so that really shifted my whole feeling about work and life and everything else, because I had lived with that for so long of wanting to take that on, to dedicate everything to the writing. But you also made me think of Natalie Goldberg's writing Down the Bones, where she says that you have to take care of making sure that you have food and shoes, because writing will leave you out in the rain without an umbrella and barefoot and hungry. And so that, you know, those different ways of how you balance life and body and health. And the other thought I have too, so one of the arguments that I have, and Annalise has heard about this already, one of the arguments that I have with Ansa Dua scholars, with a lot of panels at the Society for the Study of Gloria Ansa Dua conference that happens every 18 months or so, with people that quote and write about Ansa Dua, and maybe a little bit with Ansa Dua herself. My argument is on the ever-present focus on wound, pain, and trauma. Mm-hmm. Because what has been the most inspiring and illuminating to me, and I think, and I just read a letter to Third World Women Writers again right now, and I just like, that is what, to me, I always go back to because it feels like lightning in my veins. And I feel like that keeps getting overshadowed by people's focus on pain, wound, and trauma and darkness. And, you know, how much people, how often people quote Anzaldúa's, you know, quotation about the border being that wound between the first world and the third world. And to me, there's an issue with how we as writers, women, activists, spiritual people, whatever it may be, the desire to identify with a wound, which for me, I don't think is the strongest legacy of what Anzaldúa wrote mm-hmm. and of the energy that she brought into the world. For me, it always goes back to transformation and to medicine. And I would say to me, that's the strongest influence that she's had on my work, because that is all my work is about. When I was writing my first short story collection, which has 9 stories in it, I thought half of them would be about transformation and half of them would be about self-destruction. And what I discovered as I was writing it was that self-destruction was way too easy to write. Mm-hmm. I knew all of that. Those were very predictable. It was much more challenging, much more difficult, and required more poetry, required more art, more focus, more body, more presence to figure out how to wrestle creation and transformation out of difficult situations rather than the other. And so that's what I want to see more of. That's what I want to hear more of, because I think it's too easy for people to identify with a wound.
100%, Irene. It was that essay, Speaking in Tongues, and La Prieta, the two pieces from This Bridge Called My Back, that spoke to me the most. And in La Prieta, she has that section where she acknowledges all the pain, but then she says, I still have hope. I know there's another way. I know we're all connected. I know something else is possible. And it's that visionary determinism that has always really spoken to me. So yeah, the wound is very real, but there is also the healing and the ongoing of the healing, right? And I think, I don't know if it's that academics and, you know, activists think that becomes spiritual bypassing, because it's not. She's not bypassing the pain. She's just not stopping with it. And I think that is such an important lesson, and that's what can energize us to continue moving forward. And I agree with you. It gets lost all the time. You know, and it speaks to that balance, right? It's not mm-hmm. just like sitting around holding hands, singing Kumbaya. That's not what she's doing. She's doing something far more difficult as she's trying to put together how that transformation can happen as she's struggling with it in her own life and calling it in her own life. And I think leaving us with some really valuable clues that we could be bold and build on.
Definitely. I remember the first time I heard you speak was at the Mundo Sorba conference in 2010. And it was fascinating to me. And actually, this is the whole reason that I ended up editing the Iman Iman, the writer, the poet speaking on the Borderlands, was because of that session that you had. Because I believe in your paper, what I remembered most was that you were talking about Anzaldúa's view of language as having the potential, like not just the language, not just the symbols, not just the words, not just the stories, but that in the act of telling the story, or you know, whether it was story or history or testimony, that it had the potential to heal a person right then and there, like mm-hmm. as a text. And so I was so taken by that, and by the idea that, you know, when I think about all of the different arts that people practice, they appeal directly to one of the senses. But when you think about writing, it is literally symbols that we are looking at and interpreting and that are working within our own minds. So it made complete sense to me that it wouldn't just be that she's documenting medicine and documenting transformation. It literally is, here it is. If you are ready, if you can take it, here it is. And this is how you do it. And then you figure out your own way to do it and figure out your own way to take it and figure out your own way to learn from it. There's what is that quote about? That a healer isn't a person who heals you. A healer is a person who shows you how to heal yourself.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I think that is the best capture of the essence of what Anzaldúa was doing in her writing. And I think that's what was, I think, Nate, actually, you put it in the quotes too about the writing process and the work that it took to refine it and to actually, you know, get the words down, because it's not just the work of trying to be polished or to sound educated or intelligent or whatever else, or to be, you know, breakthrough. The work is trying to make it do that. Which actually now I'm thinking about also the fact that when I talk to writers, so, you know, I don't approach this as a non-symbolic scholar. I approach everything as a writer and poet. But when people ask me, like, what is the most important thing to tell a writer? What I found incredibly valuable to me is that when I revise things and when I tell people when they're revising, don't think about polish and style. Revise for the truth. Are you telling the truth the best way you can tell the truth? Is there a truer way to say what you're saying? Even if it's characters' dialogue, are they saying the truth of who they are in every word? And so you don't, you have to train your ear not to what sounds pretty, but you have to train your ear to what sounds true. And I can see how that is a huge challenge, because I think as a writer or artist, it can't just be about the writing. It also has to be about your life. You have to be true to yourself and tell yourself the truth, as hard as that may be. Otherwise, how do you find the medicine?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, I have so many thoughts too. One thing I'm thinking is, and there's a little bit of it in the reader. There's a little piece where it's the author talking to LP, right? And I think that's part of how she did her work, especially with the fiction. She would talk to the characters and ask them questions and step aside so the characters could answer. And of course, if the character she's talking to is La Prieta, who's also her, there's this interesting way that it's going really deep. So I do think that's part of it. And I mean, and I'm just thinking of my personal writing process. I do feel like, especially when I'm writing about Anzal Dua, I'm writing with her. Like I do things like little rituals to be in dialogue with her. But then I also think there can be this way that we're in dialogue with the words themselves and with the concepts themselves. So that what's created goes beyond the rational mind. And it's this other. And again, I'm not, you know, I'm not a poet. So I am talking about kind of like, I don't know, whatever the heck it is I write. But yeah, it's a stepping aside so new insights can emerge. And there's and it needs to be accompanied with a kind of intellectual humility.
I love that the phrase intellectual humility, because I think that goes back to, if you don't create that sense, if you don't nurture intellectual humility, how are you ever able to listen to the body? You've got to step aside. Otherwise, the mind just keeps saying, well, that's not rational. Well, that's not this. Well, that's... And I think for me, like with Borderlands, and which I think I probably have been arguing with people for a while, the reason that it's important to write from the body and to speak from the body is because people can debate with you and argue with you on anything you say. But how can they debate what your own body is saying? Like, you can't deny the truth of someone else's body.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, Anzal Dua, it took her a long time to listen to her own body, right? Because of that incredibly early menstruation and going through puberty at the age of 6. And having that really horrible periods every 28 days, which in some interviews she talks about, oh yeah, the pain was so consistent, I forgot about it. Right. Mm-hmm. So coming to terms with her body, I think that's one of the things she was still really working on. And one of the many reasons I'm sorry she passed so relatively young, because it would have, you know, there's a couple of places where she uses the phrase, the Napantla body. And she's not talking about a body out there. It's our Napantla body within ourselves, in like a kind of internal liminality that's really worth exploring and thinking about where that could take us.
Well, and then you add all kinds of, you know, trauma and shame that's on the body of woman generally, you know, and then start adding everything else. So it made me think of, there's a writing workshop I do on women writing graphic sex, because I felt that it seemed to be missing. There's many times and where I was like, it's very odd that this isn't being used as a possibility in the creation of a work to explain, you know, what's going on with the characters and the story and whatever else. Not gratuitous, but stuff that would, like, it would fill a missing gap in the narrative. And so far, I think I've done this, what, 4 times already? The second time surprised me the most, because I had writing prompts. I had all kinds of discussion questions. Yeah, I had, you know, planned it to last 2 hours. The first time roughly 2 hours, but there was only about four people because I was trying it out. The second time I had 15 women. I had planned for 2 hours. It was 4.5 hours long.
Holy cow.
Because the whole first 2 hours, we couldn't even get to the prompts, the discussion questions, the reading samples. We couldn't get to anything because apparently we needed to have a huge discussion about body shame and body appearance and being in our bodies and sexual identities and identifying with a sexual body and experiencing pleasure, like before we could even get to the workshop. And so I think, you know, that I wonder sometimes if that's why people access Ansaldúa through pain or shame, because that's what they're familiar with or still working through, instead of accessing it through pleasure or transformation. Because we still need to have those discussions. They're happening more, but
Wow.
we still there's still a huge mountain of discussion that needs to happen about women being like really being in their bodies. And then how that relates to the creation of art or theory or anything else.
Boy, like I'm gonna have to like chew over that thought a lot because I think you're really onto something. I think that's very possible. So that it, yeah. And I just have to say some of her fiction, which at some point people will be reading, will really help to elicit those conversations because the fiction is so embodied. It's gonna really surprise people.
Yeah, yes, also much for me to think about as well. We touched a little bit on process already, and I don't know, at least from what I understand, Ansaldúa was quite a reviser. Yeah, I wonder if you could talk more a little bit more about her process for us.
Yes, she was a perfectionist when it came to her writing. And I do think that her time, her second time in graduate school when she was at UC Santa Cruz, she was rejected by the History of Consciousness program. Maybe, you know, for whatever reason. So she went into the American Literature program. She took a lot of academic courses. She wanted to be seen as, and she genuinely was an intellectual. But I cannot help wonder how that really fed into her perfectionism, which was already pretty strong if you look at all the drafts. She loved to revise. When we put together our edited collection, This Bridge We Call Home, she had really great eye and really great insights for authors and how they could revise. She started with scraps of ideas. She started with dreams. She started with, there's hundreds and hundreds of pages of handwritten notes. And it seems to me that those notes were often the germination for something. Then, because she made her living as a writer, occasions would come along when people wanted her to give a talk or to write something. And so that then just became part of the seed or whatever that would start to grow what she wrote about. And she would just pull from different things and just revise constantly. I mean, her essay, which is the final chapter of Light in the Dark, there's literally two boxes of copies of it with her and me going back and forth because she just kept editing it and editing it. And at the time, I was really so this would be in 2000 and 2001. It's the closest I ever was to being annoyed with her because honestly, forgive me, Gloria, it seems selfish because we had like 60 people waiting for this book to be published and everything was done but her essay and she wasn't willing to let it go. But it's Gloria. So, you know, okay. So it comes out a year late because she's still working on her thing and it's not good enough for her. And who's going to tell her it's good enough? But now reading it, I'm like, I get it. Like, yeah, okay. She had to wait that. That was her process and what she created was really great. But that said, I think when she was doing Light in the Dark and she had that mindset of this is also a dissertation, my professors or however she saw her audience will be reading. I do think there's at least one occasion when she overwrote. She had multiple audiences for it and she overwrote it. So that's the danger in doing too much revision, right? It's the whole you have to let it go sometimes. And I actually think she always probably felt like she was letting it go too soon, you know? Like that, and that's why her short stories, for the most her short story book that she literally worked on from the 80s never got published. She just kept revising and letting the characters grow. So that's a little, and I should say this about her writing process. It was very ritualistic, right? And she talks about it in some of her pieces. Like she had her little altars, her altaritas. She had her incense. I think there's probably other things that she did as well that she didn't necessarily like tell us that she was doing, but all of it is part of the process.
Thank you for that. And the well, this is a little bit different, but just thinking about the how she writes in various different genres and kind of whatever it calls for at the time, it had me thinking just now about, and you mentioned this, Ana Luis, in the document of questions that I sent ahead of time. I mentioned Hispanic American and that, and you know, that's assimilationist among many other things, as you said. But as I was reading more, I you know, yeah, she kind of fought against being categorized as one thing, which I thought was a very powerful stance to take, and then that also, you know, living life on the borders, right, of all these things. I think she describes herself once as a spider with legs in different places. Mm-hmm. And so I like that sort of mindset in as terms of, like, maybe for lack of a better term, demographic groupings of people. How do you think that impacted her writing as well? Or perhaps it's vice versa, or maybe it's just kind of all at the same time, as far as being, you know, approaching different genres and forms of writing while also at the same time refusing to be placed into a specific box of sexuality or gender or ethnicity or class. I just found that aspect of her adamant refusal for that specifically inspiring and fascinating. I wonder if either of you have thoughts on that.
I'm going to add to that question. Did she ever say anything about what different genres were for?
That's a great question. I don't know if she did. I honestly wonder how she thought about genres, right? I know, like, she did a lot of writing workshops. And when you look at her writing workshops, it seems like the exercises and things that she had people doing very much started with early memories and eliciting that, and eliciting all those connections that a writer has with their own, you know, kind of stuff. I'm going to have to, you know, maybe this is going to be one of those questions, like when you asked about, does she write about love, right? It's going to take me in all sorts of directions, Irena.
Because that had me thinking about something my brother said a long time ago. He said that he felt, well, in his case, he was mostly considering Latina writers. But he said something about how, because we're so used to having to sort of chameleon into one thing and into another, that it made sense that you have different Latina writers that write in different genres, because we're just used to slipping between one thing and another.
Yeah.
And so, you know, because otherwise there's a lot of Latina writers that are just like, let me hop the genre fence and do something else.
Like differential consciousness. This is the context, I'll do this. This is the context, I'll do this. And I think with Anzaldu and identity, I think that really early menstruation and that marked sense of difference made her feel simultaneously confident in her identity and also able to see connections with all sorts of people. So yes, absolutely, she was Chicana, but she didn't necessarily always identify specifically as Chicana. It would depend on the audience. Like, you also have these places in her writing when she's like, I'm a planetary writer, or that's a bad paraphrase, but it's that idea of wanting to be global, not wanting to only have one audience. And then you look at her identification about sexuality, it's all over the place, right? And if you look at the interview, she's like, well, yeah, when I wrote that, because I asked her that question when I interviewed her in 91, I'm like, well, so you're saying you made a choice to be queer. Moraga says, no, you were always gay. And in my head, I'm like, and I see in her writing this incredibly strong attraction to her friend Randy. Like, you know, she's all over the place, which is fine, because it's other people who want to put the labels on. So there's that, but there's also her saying, well, at that time I said I was this, now I say I'm this. And maybe down the road, she had this whole theory of identity stations. Like, we're like, our life is like on a journey, and there's certain way stations where we have more opportunity or desire or whatever to kind of change. So how she self-identified changed a lot. She never liked Hispanic. Like, that's pretty clear. Although when we look at her early journals, we'll have to see what she says. But I think she was really aware of how important she was to young Chicanas. And I think that she would clearly like heighten that part of herself when it would be useful for her audience, right?
Because, I mean, yeah. One of the big things in terms of identity, one of the things that was immense for me, but that I think is still immensely impactful on people who are reading the work now for the first time is her strong identification with indigeneity, because it has been for so long shamed out of people and denied. And that hits in such a strong way, because it gives us a different way of belonging. As a Latina, as a Chicana, as a Mexican-American Tejana writer, I end up on a lot of panels with other writers who identify as Latina or Hispanic or Chicana or Tejana, whatever they identify as. And it's always fascinating to me that not just in the, you know, in mainstream culture, but even within our own circles, that everyone assumes that if we identify as Latina in any way, that we are either immigrants or first generation. I am not. I'm probably a combination of third, fifth, seventh Mexican generation, sixth Spanish generation, and then a whole bunch of indigenous from both sides of the border. And it gives us a different way, I think, of looking at identity if we identify as indigenous across national lines. I remember I was in a panel and I said, you know, I have as much right as anyone else to say who belongs here, you know, and if I see they are my cousins, they are my cousins, because indigenously they are all my cousins on both sides. And so it starts to give us a different way of looking at things globally. And I'm pretty sure all of that to me came from Montaldúa, not from my family who was trying to deny all indigeneity and African roots. But that's, you know, that's a very strong and powerful influence that Antaldúa had and has on people.
And of course, what she's being criticized for among some. But I agree with you. She, early on, when her own family was denying the indigenous or any African ancestry, she was clear, like, hey, this is us too. We are this. And so there's that. Then I think when she read indigenous philosophy as well as Western esoteric, like she could see her ideas and sense of things and connection with the land reflected back to her in ways that affirmed for her. So I think that was all really important. And then I think also she had if we think of her like metaphysics, she had that, it's kind of a monism, but it's a very multiplicitous monism, seeing spirit in everything. If you see spirit in everything, you're not going to go around setting up borders saying you can only identify as this, you can only identify as that, you can only connect here. That doesn't work if you are seeing some kind of radical, profound, complex, differential interconnectedness, right? So it gave her a kind of boldness that kind of ends up flying in the face of many different versions of identity politics, and that clearly people still find are really uncomfortable with.
Well, and I think a lot of it too is, you know, this insistence on authenticity and by the understanding of mainstream culture. I was at a Chicanx conference, and I was talking about poetry that I had written that is occupied in that space where you know you're indigenous, you look indigenous, you have grown up in indigenous ways, you have all of that understanding and knowledge and background and family and everything, but because you don't have that piece of paper, you cannot say native, and you're uneasy with claiming indigeneity. One of the people at this Chicanx conference turned to me and gave me the whole entire story. It took her 30 years to track down the paperwork, the documentation to say that they were native. And I was saying, but some of us don't have that. Some of us, you know, we came from families that deliberately erased it from shame, from courthouses that were burned, from property records that were lost. And for me, the strongest, I think in some ways it is the strongest way that people are pushed and forced into assimilation, because they don't have the paperwork for it, because they don't have the documentation, and because they are shamed out of thinking they are authentically indigenous, then they get completely pushed out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about what you just said about Antaldúa. And I wrote a little piece. I don't think I've sent it to you, but I wrote this tiny little 500 word essay where I was discussing Toni Morrison's idea of the white gaze. There's a quote in Toni Morrison where she writes something like, you and me, we've got a lot of yesterdays. What we need now is some kind of tomorrow.
Mm.
And so the little essay is some kind of tomorrow. And it was the whole idea. And it goes back to spiritual and interconnectedness and, you know, crossing the lines of what we identify with. Because mostly people think about Toni Morrison's White Gaze in terms of marketing, explanation, how things are framed. But what I write is, what if you disconnected even what you think a story is? You know, instead of man versus man versus self, man versus time, you know, those frameworks, and disconnect all of the other assumptions. If you disconnect what we think our relationship is to time, what our relationship is to the body, what our relationships are to each other, our relationship to nature, if you disconnect all of those or any of those assumptions in any way, for me, I think that's how you get to that Antandúan interconnectedness. And I think to possibly a more indigenous way of framing life and story. Because there's stories you just can't write. There's and I appreciate how long Antandúa worked on the stories, because if your mind is so trained to write stories the way the mainstream tells you or the canon tells you that stories should be, there are so many stories you can't write. And so you literally have to figure it out from the level of symbol up to figure out how to write that story.
I'm thinking of a little VF Cordova, Apache Chicana philosopher, and she has this little chapter where she talks about it's Westerners who think of time as a thing, right? As opposed to a more processed view. And I agree with you very much. And I think that the Anzaldúa was like, if we just keep using the same forms and using the same words, we just keep replicating the same stuff. And Lord knows our world like needs something. We need other perspectives. How do we get those other perspectives? How do we really push the envelope, not in an oppositional kind of way? And she was really working with that. And I feel like even though I edited Light in the Dark and I spent so much time with that manuscript and I spent time with Gloria because I read chapters of it when she was alive, I still feel like sometimes I'll read it and it's something new. And part of me thinks she's still writing it, you know? So it's getting rewritten. And I've had some of my colleagues who work really deeply with her writing say something very similar. I've read this five times and this is new. You know, and I can't help but wonder, it's kind of like a Borges short story, right? Like there's somewhere where she's like, you know, rewriting stuff that we're getting.
The language is alive. I mean, language is energy. Okay, so I'm going to jump into another thing that I rant about a lot too, is that that's one of the things that I'm afraid of when it comes to the right, especially, well, women, Latina, Chicana writing. I'm afraid that there's so much perpetuation of what is that there isn't a break into what could be. You know, and that's what Antandúa to me over and over and over again is you break what's happening so that you can have a view into something else, an access point into something else, instead of getting caught in perpetuating the same old, you know, systems that are keeping everything broken. But language, I want to say this is maybe something I'm slightly paraphrasing from Jeanette Winterson, that it holds energy. You know, going back again to maybe what might sound a little mystical, but you know, going back to language being symbols and symbols having energy. And energy transferring, like that's what you remember when you read something. I mean, the fact that writing can make us cry and make us have epiphanies and make us, you know, that shape us for decades, it's because it holds energy in it. And so I think that's why I always come back to Antandúa, because of the energy the words hold. And it might sound very strange to a lot of people, but you know, writing that is alive. Even though she's gone, the writing is still alive.
Have you read my article where I talk about what she does as poet, shaman, aesthetics?
No, but please send that to
I'll
me.
send it to you.
All right.
I, it's kind of it was an opportunity. Like some of the external reviewers hated it, but it was an interesting opportunity because it was in a journal on feminist supposedly new materialisms. And I read a draft of one of her short stories, an early version of her story reading LP. And this is the story, it's in the reader where LP has this girlfriend. She wants to see, she's reading a book and there's all this stuff happening, but she is moving. She's bilocating. She's moving through space. She's moving through space, like through what seems like solid space into other places. So I read a draft of that. And that night I had a dream where I did that. And I could finally understand. I understood it. Like I got it. Like I did it. I got it. I get it now. And that was from her story. So I thought about that, and then I thought about in Borderlands where she talks about the words having that effect. And so I came up with this whole theory of her poet shaman aesthetics, which is all about that. Like we ingest the words and they transform us, not just, oh, now I'm happy, but in these material ways. I'll send that to you. But yeah, that's what she's doing.
Yeah.
And it all depends on our receptivity. How ready are we at? Was it, my favorite quote from Tony K. Bambara, are we ready to heal? Are you ready to heal?
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And so
It's
it
all
comes back to how ready is the reader?
Yeah, I'm right there with you on all of the power, the literal power in terms of energy of language. And from what I understand too, Anselm Dua herself was interested in spirituality and the occult as well, right?
Yeah. Her friendship. Like she was interested in it because one of her grandmothers was a curandera. She saw things. She had an encounter with her. Anzal Dua had an encounter with her Nawal when she was very young. So she lived in a reality that was more than the conventional three-dimensional. These shape-shifting things were real to her. She saw them. I think her friendship with Louisa Teach, Yoruban priestess, she's in this bridge called My Back, as well as Teach has done a lot of work on her own. I think that was very important in affirming to Anzal Dua her sense that the spiritual could be connected with social change. Anzal Dua herself, when you look at her library and the books she had with her at the time of her death, there's not only books about Mexican shamanism and other forms of shamanism, Nahualismo, but a lot of books on esoteric magical systems, whether it's Crowley or whether it's Kenneth Grant, or she studied all of this, and she studied Sri Aurobindo, who's, like yoga, but not like, not the yoga of asanas that people do all the time, but rather the mind magic, right? Aurobindo says he played a role in influencing the outcome of World War II through work that he did, like bilocating. So all of this was part of what she devoured in the 80s. She read all of this and other stuff, which supported her own experiences, but also helped her to see what humans could do as much larger than what we usually do. Right? So not in an escapist way. It gets collapsed into a vapid new age thinking or even into conspirituality these days. That's not what she was about. She was about what are all the tools to make change and to make my writing better, right? I mean, I think that was part of it. Yeah, I think it was really important to her. And you see it in a lot of her journal notes. She had a whole like Wiccan book of days. I mean, like she and she learned astrology. She used astrology. She used a lot of different esoteric systems. So yeah, it was really important.
Yeah, I like the notion of thinking of them as tools for change. Like, yeah, what's in our tool shed that we can use, and yeah, that is certainly one of them. As we're getting close to the end here, do either of you have passages prepared that you'd like to read aloud of Anzal Dua's as well? Maybe this is a good way we can give Anzal Dua the last word on this.
Annalise, what do you have? What do you want to read?
I have two short quotes from the interviews, and this speaks to what we were talking about with identity. I've always had a planetary vision, not just a regional or even a national one. Right? So that's how she's always had, how she's seen herself as a writer. And then this, Irena, this is for you. It's something I came across after your question from one of the conferences. How do you touch another person? You reach across the great divide with your heart in your hand, with an act of compassion, an act of kindness.
That's
I think
beautiful.
it speaks to Anzal Dua's whole spirit. I think, and in fact, if you look at the short piece by Karen Neal in Entre Mundos, when Karen talks about her experience at when Anzal Dua taught the writing course, Anzal Dua did a ritual with the class where she went around to each person with her heart in her hands and held it out to them.
I'll read the last part of the letter, and I will probably skip a, I'll skip the quote. And like I said, rereading this again, it hit me again with lightning force just now. I say, Mujer Mágica, empty yourself. Shock yourself into new ways of perceiving the world. Shock your readers into the same. Stop the chatter inside their heads. Your skin must be sensitive enough for the lightest kiss and thick enough to ward off the sneers. If you are going to spit in the eye of the world, make sure your back is to the wind. Right of what most links us with life, the sensation of the body, the images seen by the eye, the expansion of the psyche and tranquility, moments of high intensity, its movement, sounds, thoughts. Even though we go hungry, we are not impoverished of experiences. Many have a way with words. They label themselves seers, but they will not see. Many have the gift of tongue, but nothing to say. Do not listen to them. Many who have words and tongue have no ear. They cannot listen and they will not hear. There is no need for words to fester in our minds. They germinate in the open mouth of the barefoot child in the midst of restive crowds. They wither in ivory towers and in college classrooms. Throw away abstraction and the academic learning, the rules, the map and the compass. Feel your way without blinders. To touch more people, the personal realities and the social must be evoked. Not through rhetoric, but through blood and pus and sweat. Write with your eyes like painters, with your ears like musicians, with your feet like dancers. You are the truth-sayer with quill and torch. Write with your tongues of fire. Don't let the pen banish you from yourself. Don't let the ink coagulate in your pens. Don't let the censors snuff out the spark, nor the gags muffle your voice. Put your shit on the paper. We are not reconciled to the oppressors who wet their howl on our grief. We are not reconciled. Find the muse within you, the voice that lies buried under you. Dig it up. Do not fake it. Try to sell it for a hand clap or your name in print. Love, Gloria.
Well, that seems like as good a place as any to sign off here. Ana Luis, Reina, thank you again very much for joining me today. Much like you both, also many more thoughts to ponder as well. And I did not know Anzaldúa, but I feel like she would not want it any other way, right? To keep on thinking and transforming and growing, and of course, writing. So thank you both for this inspiring conversation.
Yeah, thank you for doing this.
Bye, Nate. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.